Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Columbine, Fort Hood, Aurora, Orlando, Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook, and now Las Vegas. America, once again, this week broke a record for the most number of people killed in a mass shooting. My guest today, Dave Cullen, has been writing about these kinds of tragic shootings for almost two decades. He's the author of the book Columbine, which he spent 10 years reporting and writing, which tells the story of that fateful day in 1999 at a Colorado high school. Dave joins me today to explain why these devastating shootings keep happening in America, the kinds of people who decide to murder innocents in such cowardly ways, and why he thinks that eventually these mass shootings could stop happening altogether. Thanks so much, Dave, for joining us. So, this week I woke up, as most Americans did, and you looked at my phone and there had been yet another mass shooting in America. You've been, you wrote the book on Columbine. You've been writing about this issue for almost two decades now. Do these things still shock you?
Yes, in some ways, the magnitude of this did. In fact, oddly enough, I told a friend, I had trouble getting my arms around this because it was too much. I couldn't even conceive. When we had over 500 people injured, I couldn't even picture that. Although partly, I guess I didn't want to picture that. I kind of refused. But yeah, it's still horrifying.
So you, the book that you wrote on Columbine, you spent, how many years did you spend reporting that?
Well, 10 on the first edition, and then I've sort of kept up, and it was another 6 years to the expanded edition.
So do you think that part of what we see in these mass shootings is a result of the mass shootings before, it seems like a good idea because some lunatic sees some other lunatic who's done it, and so on and so forth, or are these kind of more isolated, or what's your theory given what you know about all these things?
It's definitely self-propagating, if you want to call it that. It's it builds on its own fuel, and for a while there was some dissent about that with sort of the mental health experts I talked to, criminologists, some FBI profilers who are retired now, who I confer with on all these things, and they weren't kind of sure. But then what really was convincing to just about everybody who's involved in this is the fact that they copy each other. And actually, in the I should have pulled this up, but in the epilogue, I went through some of the last just a few years. Got about 10 different examples in just the 2 years prior to me doing that, so going about the last 3 years. Most of those people are referencing Columbine specifically in either, I hate to say this, but since they are performances, the costumes they do, the methods, some actually choosing the same day, anniversaries in some way, and then writing about and specifically naming Columbine and or the two Columbine killers in their manifestos or their other descriptions of what they're doing, and then mimicking those attacks. And when not Columbine specifically, they're almost always citing and mimicking the ones before, and you can see it in what they're doing. And you can see the fact that this is, I've been railing this week against scorekeeping and, calling this, awarding them this medal, or this guy, this medal is the deadliest shooting in modern American history, whatever we're calling it. It's not surprising that we keep breaking these records. And I saw somebody tweeting this afternoon, actually, the biggest one, and Columbine is barely on the list anymore because they keep dwarfing each other, and that's not a coincidence. They are, a template has been created largely by Columbine. That's what sort of put this on the map as a thing to imitate and a way to gain a sense of notoriety as and a sense of stature as sort of an anti-hero or whatever you want to call it. And since then has become a thing, and the more gruesome it gets, the more it keeps going. And I'll just I'll throw out one other aspect of that. I pointed out a couple of years ago, and I've written and talked a lot about this, that it's become very clear, and the killers have figured out, that there are two ways to sort of become star of the week, media star of the week. Because, by the way, there are so many of these that we barely hear about, and most of them barely even make the national news, or it's just an incidental thing. A small number become this massive story, and of course the media runs only kind of on two speeds. We're all it or not. But the way you become this massive star of the week, you have to do one of two things. You either do something really original and creative, and I hate to put it in those terms, but that's exactly it. It's a performance, and you got to be a creative performance where you do something new and novel, or you break some records. And best case, if you do both, then you're golden for the media, and you're a media star for the week. And the killers figured that out long before the rest of us have.
So when one of the things that's so frustrating to me, I grew up in England. We did not deal with these issues ever. There was no gun violence.
You had the Dunblane or in Scotland. So it wasn't England, but in the UK, you had your sort of one horrible one.
We did have our issues. I grew up in England during the IRA bombings, but even then, it was nothing like this ever. And the thing that I can't get my head around is the response by pro-gun, NRA, Fox News, and so on and so forth, that we, A, can't talk about it right now. We're not allowed to, which I think is just complete and utter nonsense. But B, that they feel the need to kind of, it's almost like they're defending the people who did the thing because guns are more important than they're not being guns. You must have spoken to people at these institutions, at the NRA and things like that. Did they feel any kind of remorse or sadness or anything when these things happen?
Now that they're expressing, I don't know what's going on in their head or their heart or whether they're conflicted. But if they're not, they have definitely made a decision not to let on any of that. To me, it's a matter of priority, and maybe that's kind of an inexact word for it, or it's not a big enough word, but it's sort of like you've got a loved one who's dying of cancer, and you can help them, but you don't because you've got some paperwork to fill out for work. I mean, it's sort of that sort of like ridiculous, preposterous, like, really, that's your priority? Where, okay, I understand you want to hunt and you want to be able to have guns and, fire them off. It can be fun to go shooting them off. I get that. But that balanced against this massive priority of people dying over and over and all of us at being at risk, the unwillingness to have any of your own joy be sort of maybe constricted a little bit, it's just unfathomable to me why they aren't willing to, we all have to make sacrifices about different things. And like, okay, so a little of your sport, maybe you can't do everything you want. And you can still hunt for a deer with a rifle. But, basic things like, you don't need a 50-round magazine or 100-round, any of these sort of really large magazines to do that. No one is shooting that many times at a deer, need a new hobby.
Do they truly believe that Americans should be able to have a 50-round, 100-round magazine, or do they think that if they give just an inch to, the Democrats and that want it,
I think it's more of the latter. I mean, there are definitely some people who are like, I'm going to have what I want, and I don't care, and nobody's going to tell me what not to have. There are some of those, but I think the larger I think the larger chunk, you know, and I don't know these people as well as some others, but I have a feeling that if you ask them what's in their heart, and if you could somehow assure them, you know, if God could step in and say, like, look, if you give in on the magazines, we won't do anything else, that I have a feeling most of them would say, okay, that's pretty reasonable. We'll do that. But no one can make that assurance. And, you know, to some degree, they might be right. I mean, part of, you know, politics is a momentum game, too. And, God, you know, we shouldn't even be admitting this out loud, but sometimes, you know, the gun safety side has really been stymied, partly because so many of us are just distraught and have sort of given up, really, and don't vote on this issue and don't even fight as much because we always lose, and it just feels like pounding our head against a brick wall. And I think if we were to make some sort of incremental gains and start, you know, getting some sensible things that everybody sort of agrees with, that may create a certain amount of momentum. So, you know, from a practical point of view, I mean, they can't lie. And, you know, they may have some validity, but, you know, so what? So, you know, what I would say to them is like, you know, if you have your line here and here's where you think it should be, and we get some momentum at safety and push a little past that line, you know, slightly into your comfort zone, big deal. Deal with it. You know, and we save, you know, untold number of lives because we encroach a little bit. You know, we're not going to take away all the guns. That's never going away. The Second Amendment's not going away. So some slight encroachment, just come on, deal with it. There's other bigger things at stake. It's not all about you, is what I would say to those people.
So since you wrote the Columbine book, which is an incredible book and really kind of unravels the entire thing, I'm sure that you get a lot of emails and letters from people. Is it on both sides of the issue that people write to you? And if so, what are the kind of things that they say?
What, do you mean on both sides of the gun issue?
Yeah, I mean, are there people that you know, staunch Second Amendment rights folks that read the book and contact you, or is it mostly people?
No, I get hardly any of that. But, you know, partly, I didn't go into a lot of that in the book. I mean, for me, the book was primarily, it was a psychological study, you know, I mean, in layman, in storytelling, but, you know, not an academic. But it was an inquiry into really two things of, you know, what drove these killers. And I say this all the time, is why I wrote the book and what it's about, really, is, you know, what drove these killers, these two boys, to do this? And then, what did it do to this community? What happened, you know? And it took me 10 years to do the book, partly sort of to get some distance on it and to sort of figure it out and sort through it and research it and all. But part of it, I realized as I was doing it, like, I needed 10 years to like sort of get to maybe not an ending point, the ending point, but a far enough into the future of after 10 years, what had become of these people. You know, when I first started the book a year out, I didn't realize the time. Well, you know, their story not only wasn't done, it really hadn't reached its climax yet, so we didn't know it was going to become of these people. But anyway, so most of what I was interested in was the point of view of what's it like to be a survivor, to go through something like this, and then, you know, what drives the killers. So, actually, so most of the mail I get, I still, you know, kids, tons of schools are using it, and what I hear from most often is kids who are reading and sort of fascinated by this, and they're sort of inquisitive. I actually, you know, I'm glad to say that I don't get a lot of you know, angry male, it's much more inquisitive, except for with a huge thing. There's a huge stalker community of these kids, call themselves true crime community, who idolize killers, and, you know, especially a huge number of females who idolize them, and there's communities for each one of these notorious murderers. He is mostly high school kids really pretending, I believe, trying to show that they're cool. And so I'm sort of enemy number one with them. So I get all sorts of, you know, derogatory. I have to block literally hundreds of them a week on all these different sites. And occasionally I get death threats. I get a couple credible death threats a year that I have an FBI agent assigned to my case to look into them. But aside from sort of those outliers, you know, most of the people aren't arguing with me about guns or anything else. They're wanting to understand more, and they have questions about, you know, clarifying, like, what's going on in these people's heads, what happened with this person. And it's that, so, which is kind of nice, of people just who sort of, like, hungry to know more. So thank God for that.
You mentioned that you wanted to get into the mind of some of the survivors, and the 59 people who passed away, who were killed, 58 actually people who were killed, and it's got to be incredibly devastating for the families. I can't even comprehend where people even begin, and then over 500 injured in Vegas. What is, you know, I look at the videos of what happened there, and it looks like a war zone, and I can't imagine that every single person at that concert doesn't have PTSD from that moment. Is this something that these people have to live with for the rest of their life? Is it something that kind of goes away a little bit? Like, what is it like for the people who make it through something?
Sure.
Like this?
Yeah. That's what I was really, really fascinated by and curious about. And it's all, you know, the short answer, it's always with them. Well, I'll tell you, in the case of Columbine, most of them were sort of able to put it behind them and deal with them, and some still struggle with it. You know, in that particular case, I mean, there were sort of 2,000 kids in the school, roughly. And the day after was really, really shocking for me, because I was out there the afternoon it happened, the first hour, and day two was so drastically different than day one and was, for me, so much worse, which surprised me. So, you know, the first day was just horrifying out there. And but it was exactly what you would kind of expect the survivors. It was pandemonium. It was crying, just sobbing, yelling when people would sort of reunite with each other and come running toward each other and, like, hugging, so much hugging and clenching and just sort of trying to squeeze it out of them. So there were no surprises to me at all that day. And, you know, I slept not enough and went back out to the high school in Clement Park, this big park surrounding the school, in the morning. And, well, first to Light of the World Church is where they had this big first sort of gathering. And I was stunned because it was they had literally changed overnight. And almost all the kids just had these vacant stares, like they had been shell-shocked. Just, you know, psychologists describe it as a blank affect. And, you know, not kids here, there are almost nobody. I didn't see anybody crying. And the boys were worse than the girls. They were just like walking zombies. And, you know, my first struggle as a reporter was I was just insanely curious to talk to them about it and see what was going on and see how they felt about it. And see if, you know, their version of it was what I was observing. And I didn't know how. I didn't want to be this, you know, dick reporter who comes up, you know, and psychoanalyzes them or something. So I first did it by walking up to a group of boys and sort of blaming on other boys and saying, like, you know, those guys over there, like, look like, you know, I'm not seeing anybody, like, emoting or crying at all. And they just were so happy to talk about it. And from then on, I talked about it to kids all day long, because they had, almost nobody had slept, and they could tell you when they had stopped crying and stopped feeling, because for most of them, it was like a light switch that went off at like 3 a.m. or 6 a.m. or whatever. They went from sobbing and everything to nothing. And like in all of them, something just switched off where they hit overload. And that's really why I knew that I was going to spend quite a while on this story, because I had to know what was going to become of them. And I'm happy to tell you that for a lot of them, it took more than 5 years. I would say about by the 8-year point, most of them had reached a plateau where they didn't even want to talk about it with their friends anymore at reunions. That would tell me, like, we're sick of even talking about it amongst ourselves. And yeah, they had sort of gotten through it and put it behind them, never completely. It was, you know, they say, like, it'll always be a part of my life. It's something that happened to me, something awful. But they were able to deal with it. It was the parents who had more difficulty. The parents of the injured, and especially the killed, who some of them have never gotten over it. So, you know, we're dealing with an interesting cohort there where these were high school kids. I've studied so many of these killings, but not in remotely the same depth. So I don't know if these people who are of various different ages, 20s, 30s, 50s, 70s, you know, whatever, if kids are more resilient and these other people may grapple with it longer. But what I can tell you from talking to a lot of psychologists and trauma experts over the years, like most people won't have PTSD. Even in a war zone, it's a minority of the people who have PTSD, but it's actually a larger group then that have depression, which is something shy of PTSD, but is obviously difficult as well. So you have a large group typically that has the somewhat milder symptoms of depression, and then, you know, single digits-ish, typically who, you know, have, you know, severe enough to be called PTSD. So some of these people that's going to be with them for life, most probably not, I guess, would be sort of, you know, based on what I know of what's likely to happen, which, you know, sort of good news, bad news thing.
This is Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
I want to take a minute to thank my sponsor, ProFlowers, which I've been using on a weekly basis myself. The ProFlowers site is incredibly easy to use, and they pretty much have flowers for every single occasion and even non-occasions, like the fall or just to tell someone that you're thinking of them. ProFlowers has a ton of amazing features that you just can't get on other floral services. Their bouquets are guaranteed to stay fresh for at least 7 days, or they'll give you your money back. You can control the delivery date of the person who gets them. The stems are longer. The roses are fuller. I could just keep going on and on about this. They have so many special bouquets right now for the fall, including their best-selling cinnamon cider roses. And no, you cannot eat those. This week, ProFlowers is giving listeners of Inside the Hive a 20% off any ProFlowers unique bouquets that cost over $29 or more. To get that special 20% off, all you need to do is go to ProFlowers.com and use the code HIVE, that's H-I-V-E, at checkout. Once again, go to ProFlowers.com and use the code HIVE at checkout. So one of the things that, I mean, I you know, it's pretty insane that we... that this happens and continues to happen and continues to happen and continues to happen. Do you think it is ever going to change, or is this just America?
You know, I think it is going to change. I mean, we tend to
Wow.
I don't know what is going to put an end to it. In the 70s, remember hijacking was a huge thing?
Yeah.
That seemed like it was going to go on forever. And that was... you know, the closest thing to come to mind, which was also a self-fulfilling thing where, you know, people saw how sort of successful it was at their agendas, and that kept getting bigger and bolder, and they're doing more of it until we, you know, took sort of drastic steps against it. In this case, I don't know what the way out is. I do believe that these things do tend to sort of work themselves out, but I think the single biggest thing is going to be the media stop giving them the fuel and sort of suck some of the oxygen out of it. And we're finally starting to see that. I've been really shocked to see some network anchors kind of on the defensive and say, "Oh, we're not naming him anymore." And things that were just a couple years ago, that nearly all the media, when a handful of us, you know, me, Anderson Cooper, Megyn Kelly, were saying, you know, stop naming the people and be very much, you know, more discriminating against, you know, using that in the images of the killers. Now it's becoming not completely done, but a mainstream idea, and actually people sort of expecting that, you know, maybe we do need some limits on this, or hearing much more about, you know, not scorekeeping, and hopefully we're beginning a conversation of doing less wall-to-wall coverage. Now, I think, I heard a great shrink, I already forgot his name, this morning on CNN sort of complaining about the wall-to-wall coverage and treating him like a celebrity. And the anchor was pushing back and saying, well, we're just reporting. And I'm kind of with him, like, I want to know what we've learned about this guy. But we may get two or three scraps of information today.
Yeah,
that's
the part.
If we're talking about it literally 24 hours today.
Well, it's also, it's like, yeah, it's I understand that we need to know what the motive was. And by learning the motive, it can, maybe we can avoid it from happening again, although that doesn't seem to be the case from the past. But I get that concept. But, you know, it's like yesterday, you know, the killer's girlfriend lands in L.A. There's literally, you know, helicopters hovering over as the car's driving. And we're not going to find anything out about that that meeting with the FBI that she had for a while. And so I don't understand the wall to wall coverage either. Do you think that the media? I mean,
exactly.
is this just as much? And I do believe the media plays a huge role in this. But I'm curious what your thoughts are as someone who's been covering this so long. Is part of it just as much this 24-hour news cable cycle media nonsense that and coverage that has kind of led to some of these events?
Yeah, I really think it is. I think it's the way that we make this person the star of the week, where it is wall to wall, and they dominate everything. I think it should be obviously a big story. It should be like the lead story that first day, and then there should be, you know, reports as things develop, as we actually learn things, and, you know, not filling, which, you know, with actual news each day, what we have might fill 20, 30 minutes and not the other 23 hours. And, you know, of course, I fully support stories on the victims and so forth. But, you know, we can go back to these other stories as well. What the media loves is a sensational story. And it becomes the sort of self-fulfilling thing for them too, where as a viewer, and I, you know, I don't know about you, but I know about me is like I keep tuning in because like, oh, what is the latest thing? What is the latest thing? I don't want to miss something. Whereas if, you know, I'm just throwing out ideas here. If they had a 1-hour show each evening with the recap of what had happened that day, or you probably didn't really fill an hour. You know, if they did, you know, a 30-minute show each night, or, you know, each hour they had a 5-minute thing, you know, then I would know, like, okay, I don't have to, you know, be on the edge of my seat waiting. I'm going to get the whole thing. But, you know, they like this sort of, like, massive story that's keeping everyone going and sort of the excitement of it. You know, psychologists actually refer to something, I hate to laugh about this, but violence porn. Because there is an element of it's that same kind of allure. We all get sort of sucked in. There's something very dramatic about it. It raises our pulse, right? Even if we don't want to admit it, like there's sort of an excitement level in this when something comes up. And as human beings, we're wired to, you know, for our pulse to race. And there's a certain amount of appeal in that, whether we think about it or not. And sometimes we need to check our own things and, you know, our own and drives and realize like, oh, you know, I don't really need to know. I'm not getting that much out of this, but I'm in a perverse way enjoying it. And maybe I do need to turn it off. So, you know, some of the audience needs to do that.
Yeah, I think really, we're all just as at fault. I think, you know, the ones when, but it's, you know, people used to complain about Gawker or the website because they thought it was mean and vicious and so on. And my response was, well, but you read it. You're by clicking on that link, you are condoning it. And I feel like it's the same thing with, I definitely make a very conscious effort not to click on, you know, I don't go to the Daily Mail with these things and I don't, you know, we don't have cable, so, but we don't turn on.
Exactly. But I want to be clear. I mean, I don't really think it's the viewers and readers who are driving it. It's,
it's a bit of both.
The media can do a very responsible thing of programming, which can get us the answers and send teams out digging for us for this, where they can give a few hours a day where they do not make it this massive sort
No, but of I think that they there's a reason the reason they put it on is because people are watching it too. So I do think that it's all a little bit of both. Moving on to some of the things that have happened since Columbine. One of the things that I really have an incredibly difficult time with, and I think most people do, there's a tweet that gets sent out, retweeted every single time there's a mass shooting in the U.S. And it's something to the effect of, you know, once Americans were okay with 27 kids being killed at Sandy Hook, the gun debate was over. And I'm curious what you think about that, because that I truly do believe that. I mean, that to me, was one of the most gruesome, disgusting, vile things I've ever seen in a modern society, that people were, that the NRA and other groups seemed to defend gun rights still after that, and it didn't seem like anything changed or was going to change. Why do you think that Sandy Hook wasn't the thing that changed everything?
You know, yeah, that just makes me so incredibly sad. It's hard to even talk about. I think there are a couple things. You know, I need to go back and look at this, because I actually just saw a commentator about 30 minutes before we went on talk about that. And I want to go recheck this history. But he said that the Obama administration really made a big tactical mistake in that, because they decided they really wanted to study it and do it right and take 3 months to, you know, come up with a plan. And you know, so in their mind, they were doing the right thing. But what that really did was wait way too long. And wait till the oxygen was out of it. And that if they had done something like that week, or, you know, within, you know, 10 days or something, they had a real chance, because people were enraged and people were ready to push forward. And sort of, you know, the overwhelming majorities who feel that a lot of these things should be done were, you know, demanding to be heard. But the air goes out of that relatively quickly. And I think he's right. I think that they didn't realize that at the time, because I think they felt like this was such a moment, let's do it right, and we do have some time, and I think they miscalculated. So I do see some hope. I think, you know, we do have that chance after all these horrible things, and as much as part of my brain is agreeing with you and thinking that, by falling into that sort of self-defeatist attitude, we kind of screw ourselves, and we have to just say, like, well, you know, then we've just got to learn our lesson from this time. And frankly, some of those people in Congress just have to have a backbone. I mean, of both parties, because, I mean, I would wager that on, you know, the Republican side, too, a hell of a lot of those people, if they voted their conscience, that these bills would pass overwhelmingly. But they're in fear of their, particularly getting primaried on the right, of certain, you know, base voters. But all these people, you know, and some Democrats and sort of borderline districts, a lot of these people have to show some backbone and do the right thing and decide, even if it means this is the end of my career in Congress, you know, maybe it's worth it. And that may be a naive thing to say, but, you know, at some point you have to, if you wanted to become elected as senator or a congressman, you know, now's maybe the time. Like, this is the reason you did it. So maybe stick your neck out for something that matters. So I think one of these times, you know, we can still do it as it gets more, these get more and more outrageous.
When you look at the killers of these, you know, the biggest mass shootings since 99, really, or since 91, I guess you could say, Killeen, Texas, they all seem to have. It seems like there are moments where we are learning a little bit about the type of person. It doesn't seem like we've had, you know, that have there been specific personality types like Columbine?
Yes.
And have we started to learn anything?
I was really actually surprised. So, you know, Newsweek asked me after one of these horrors, I think it was the Aurora shooting, asked me to do a piece on the different types of killers. And I said, well, you know, I know from the FBI that there's no single profile, but, you know, maybe there's, you know, maybe there's 5 or 10. And so let me see if I can come back to you on that and do something. So, you know, I went to the FBI people and a lot of these experts and was shocked to discover there are 3. You know, and if you consider terrorism would be a 4th, but that's a whole different thing. But, you know, if we're talking about the sort of people who are doing it for their own agenda, there are, of course, outliers, but nearly all of them fall into 1 of 3 categories, which is kind of shocking and is a very manageable, understandable number. And they're pretty simple. And actually, you know, Columbine was 2 of the 3. But the most common by far is the angry depressives. And I'll tell you what all three, and then we can go into them a little more if you want. So angry depressives is by far the most common. Second most common is deeply mentally ill, and I'm talking about out of touch with the reality. And these are usually schizophrenia, sometimes paranoid schizophrenia or different variations, but really whether it's hearing voices or just not really in touch with reality. And you've got people like Virginia Tech, Gabby Giffords. Actually, the assassination of Reagan, that guy Hinckley, is actually out now because he's under treatment. So that's type number two. And then the third, which is by far the least common, is psychopaths.
And like those are genuine psychopaths.
Yes, genuine psychopaths have no empathy. And that, you know, with Eric Harris from Columbine, with that type, Dylan Klebold from Columbine was the angry depressive. Now, by the way, so in this case, we don't know whether this person fits in. And, you know, by the way, then there's some other outliers. There's sometimes brain tumors or other actual physical brain or organic problems can lead to situations. But those are very, very rare. Anyway, so the three. You know, it's way too early to tell, but I'm kind of surprised that I've been hearing more and more experts, like FBI profilers, advance the possibility that this may well have been a psychopath. Now, I wanted to say that that's one possibility and one thing that we should be exploring, but it's rather rare, and this person is showing some, you know, some bits of that, so that's a thing to explore, which usually I say, it's highly unlikely that it'll be in that one, but this time it's like, okay, that should be in the mix. It's something that we're thinking about.
So do you, you've been covering this stuff for so long and know so much about it, and I'm sure it's something you think about a lot. Do you take precautions? Do you worry when you go to the movie theater? Do you not go to the movie theater anymore? How has it affected you personally?
Well, that's pretty interesting. You know, I don't take precautions like that. What I did do very early on was sort of learn what to do and sort of really think that through.
In the event of you're in a place that there is a shooting, you're saying?
Yeah, in the event of one. And, you know, I also alerted family members. And it actually took, many years, until this was like the last 2 or 3 years, really, I've seen this push for this run, hide, fight.
So what is it that you're supposed to do?
Should. And if you go to my site or you just Google Run, Hide, Fight, TSA and several other great videos, like 2 or 3 minute videos that sort of outline. And, I mean, that's the strategy. And those are three separate things to do in that order.
So what can you walk
run,
us through what
by all
what
means, it, like 90%, more than 90% of the time, your best option is way more than 90%. Run like hell. Whatever the sound of gunfire, run away from it. And sometimes it's confusing because of ricocheting shots or so forth. You're not sure where the gunfire is coming from. Take your best guess and run. And then if, you know, you get new information, oh, maybe it's coming from that direction, turn around and run the other way. But anyway, run. If running is impossible, for instance, you're in a building, you're sort of trapped in a room, there's nowhere to go, then hide is number two. And number three, only if that fails, for instance, when the then person comes through the door, is then as a last-ditch effort, fight. And there's great scenarios on this video of, like, how to do things like, and if you think fighting is impossible, they show ways, especially when there is a barrier, like a doorway, where you've barricaded yourself in a classroom, which is, you know, fairly common scenario, this type of thing. As he comes through, the door becomes a delay. And you can see these great things. If somebody picks up, one person picks up a fire extinguisher, somebody else grabs a scissors, or whatever kind of makeshift weapons there are, anything that can be like a piece of a shard of glass or anything, a vase. And then sort of like surround the doorway. So as he's delayed coming through, you all hit him at the same time and can perhaps do something. But yeah, it's run. I remember like more than like 15 years ago in the early days, unfortunately, it took a long time to sort of figure for the general authorities to figure this out. And they were kind of telling people the wrong thing. They were, you know, talking about hiding, you know, getting down. And I kept like talking to experts about like, well, that's what the kids did at Columbine who died. And nearly all the experts who I was talking to were saying like, Yeah, what I tell my kids and what I would tell is run like crazy. And it took a while. I think for whatever reasons, the schools, they wanted discipline. They wanted, you know, somebody in control and not just like run for your life, all run away. But it took a while to figure out, like, yeah, run is the thing you should be doing. And now that has sort of become doctrine, and it's taken all this time. But yeah, I've been telling my siblings with young nieces and nephews like 15 years ago, like, here's what you need to tell your kids to do. And I'm glad that the whole public has the benefit of that. But I would advise anyone who has not watched one of those videos, do that today. And, you know, I don't feel like by going to a concert or going to an amber, like there's, you know, watching your back, like what's that going to do if somebody's opening a shoot at you? You're going to be taken by surprise. So the only thing you can really do is have yourself sort of trained in some way and gone through the scenarios and know exactly what to do when the surprise comes.
So two last questions for you before we wrap up, both a little different. But so the first question I have is, do you think that this issue is I remember watching Bowling for Columbine, and it clicked for me, and I do truly believe that the reason most people do want guns and have guns is fear. Do you think that is really what it comes down to, that a lot of this is about fear, and that you know you see these moments where every time there's a big mass shooting, the sales of guns shoot up 5,000% and so on and so forth. Do you think that the people who are so adamant about keeping guns, majority, I know that we have hunters, we have people who live in the wilderness and it's important and so on and so forth, but these, you know, that it's about the fear of what could happen to them?
Well, I don't really think so. Although, you know, I got to say that, like, I'm not a gun owner, and my specialty is not sort of like knowing that population as well. I have some friends and family who are. I do think that more of it is about. It seems to be about, you know, a sense of sport and just enjoying these things. And then, I mean, maybe fear in a way, but also this kind of weird independence. You know, this whole, you know, frontier American ideal of that, like, you know, I could take care of myself if I wanted to. And maybe we're saying the same thing, but if I ever needed to, I'm armed and, like, I can protect my family. I just don't, when I talk to these people, I don't really sense fear that they're actually afraid that something is going to happen. Is more sort of a proactive, like, I'm going to be like, you know, like the old style, like necessarily the provider, like the dad, but more like the protector type paternalistic idea that, and just enjoying using them and not wanting anybody to tell you otherwise. Those seem to me like bigger drivers, but yeah, but I need to confess that, you know, I'm not an expert on that. And I haven't done my due diligence in the field nearly as much on that population. Mm-hmm. So I might be miscalling those shots a little.
All right. So last question. Whenever these things happen, I always think, well, what is it that I can do? And I'm sure you get that question from a lot of people. What is the advice that you give people that want to do something, that to try to help the issue, raise awareness, protect people? What do you tell them that they can do?
Well, I mean, I think there's the, you know, there's not a lot, that general people can do in certain areas, you know, sort of that we have is like publicizing these things. But there's a couple things they can do. I mean, one obviously is become part of the push for sensible gun safety measures, calling your congressman, going to rallies or whatever, and saying, hey, we're not going to put up with this anymore. But, you know, there's something in a completely in a different vein that they can do, that I'll tell you that it's not about stopping them, but is about victims and survivors. And I'll tell you I've talked to and met with and spent a lot of time with survivors of so many of these things, that I've studied with groups, and I get brought into groups that study after Virginia Tech and the Norway shooting, and lots of people, in depth with these people. And the complaint is always some version of the same thing, which is a version of don't rush our healing. And what I mean by that is people who've never thought they're rushing the healing do. So 6 months from now, a year from now, or even 2 years from now, you're going to hear stories about some of these people. And, well, first of all, some of the stories in the not-too-distant future are going to be these great overcoming stories and how this person has put them behind this behind them. Well, I'll put it another way. It actually, I think the five-year anniversary from Columbine, some of the people who I interviewed, some of the students said, there was a narrative developing among the media who were coming out to do the story that, like, oh, so many of these kids have overcome it. And that became sort of the thing of, like, oh, they've really put it behind them. And then some kids, it wasn't at all behind them, were feeling like, ugh, like, I don't even want to be a part of that. I don't want to have to pretend, and feeling this need. But long before 5 years, that idea starts to come through, and we call it compassion fatigue, and a lot of different names where people start souring on, like, why are these people still whining about it? And you may think right now, like, oh, I would never do that. Give it a year or 6 months and see how sometimes some of these stories among people, you know, you may be like, oh, God, really? They're still, that happened a year ago. You know, they need to get on with their lives, or just, you know, well-meaning things like, you know, talking about how, like, oh, what can we do to help these people get on with it or get them closure? They hate that goddamn word closure. That becomes the most hated word of any survivor, because they hear that as, get over it, done with it. Like, when is the sort of expiration date on their grief that they're supposed to be done and have it closed off? And their thought is, like, never. I'm like, this is never going to be closed. So in 100 different ways, and I'm not conveying nearly as well as I should, most of us participate in it out of this well-meaning, you know, wanting to help them get over it and get past it. And, we want them to get past it way before they're ready, years before. And I'll give you one more example and then shut up on it. It's like the day two headline of the Denver Post after Columbine. So this is like 36 hours after. Well, this banner heading across the full top of the front page, healing begins. And every pastor, mental health worker, anybody who's worked with victims, grief counselors, it was a face plant down, and it was like, healing doesn't begin a day and a half after. They're not even beginning their grief. They're still in shock. Like, you know, healing might start beginning for these people in 6 months or something. And already they were rushing to, like, oh, we're getting you past it. And it's this feeling of, we want to help you heal and get over it. And they hear that as, like, what's taking you so long? And so whether you deal with these people one-on-one, or you're posting on Twitter or some site, somebody's reading that who's probably connected and is going to hear in 1,000 different ways messages from you of, like, hurry up and get over it. And they need to take 2 or 3 or 10 times as long as you think they need, and they're all different. So some people are going to be healed as fast as you want or hope they will, and others won't, and everybody's different, and they want to do it at their own pace, and they don't want to be feeling this pressure from all of us to get on with it. And they really, really do. It is a gigantic thing. So that's what, you know, that's what you can do as a participant, is not participate in that feeling of sort of rushing their healing.
And if you want to, you know, make your voice heard, or, you know, is it best to give Congress people money that are against this, or they're against guns, or at least, you know, semi-automatic weapons?
I would think so. You know, the other thing is to do, you know, you can actually vote on it. You know, one of the biggest problems with getting this stuff passed is, if it's something like 4 or 5 times as much. So even though more people want this sort of, large majorities want, you know, legislation for gun safety, most of the people who want gun safety measures don't vote on it as a primary voting thing. And people who do, who are against any kind of new measures, tend to vote on it as a single issue. And so you know, you're running for Congress.
What do you mean they don't vote on
and,
it?
Yeah, 1%, just, you know, most of the people are with you, but only 1% of them is going to, you know, vote based on what you do.
Is it that they don't?
Even if it's only 5 or 10%
of... Yeah.
Yeah, if gun rights people are going to vote against you, you don't know, even a moderately close election, that could be the balance. So, yeah, at some point, you have to, like, we put our, you know, votes where our mouth is, and actually not just say we support these things, but actually vote on it.
Yeah, I think that that's, that could be said about a lot of issues in this country.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thank you, Dave. I really appreciate you taking the time to answer these questions. And, you know, once again, under not the greatest circumstances. Thank you for writing such an incredible book. I urge everyone to go and read it. It is fascinating, even almost 20 years later. Yeah, thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks. This is a great interview. I appreciate interviewers actually sort of want to go into depth in these and not, you know, get the 15-second soundbite answers, which I don't think
well,
Ed
it's the beauty of the podcast. I wish we didn't have to go into such depth on some of these stories, but it's really great to hear your input, so thank you.
All right, thanks, Nick.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Thanks to my guest, Dave Cullen. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work and my editors at Vanity Fair. And thanks, of course, to my sponsor, ProFlowers. I'll see you all next week.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts. From PR.